know there was a college Christmas party tonight? NFI, me and you. Not fucking invited. You all right?
Yeah, I've got a flat tire.
Take my bike.
Hey, that is so kind. Thank you. I'm sorry I don't know your name. I'm Felix.
Oliver.
Oliver. Oliver, I love you. I love you. All right, cheers, Ollie!
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of? What do you mean, problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your co-host, Bill Antoniou, and with me is...
Michael Soulard.
There he is. Mikey, how are you?
I'm good. I missed you.
I missed you, too. I'm so happy you were able to join me for this one and to join this full house of commentators mm-hmm. we have, because this is a movie that's really drawing people out, if you know what I mean. Our special guests today are well known to our podcast listeners because they've been on before. They are much loved, much lauded. First of all, we have the one and only Ryan G. Hines.
I'm so excited to be here to talk about the film that has captured the zeitgeist like no other movie has in the history of cinema.
And Ryan, I should point out that you are actually the person who suggested we do this film. In fact, It was going to take me forever to watch it. And the reason why I've even seen it as soon as this is because of you.
Well, I watched it twice, Ryan, so thank you for that.
Oh, wow.
I think I'm up to number 6 in terms of viewings. So I really love it.
Oh, we're not going to be friends by the end of this. Okay. Also joining us today is, of course, one of our favorite guests on this show, the one and only Gregory Roseborough. Hello, Greg.
Hello, everyone.
Lars.
I just watched this movie on the big screen last night, so it's fresh in my memory.
Yes.
How is that on the big screen?
Drinking jizz from a bathtub, as beautiful as you can imagine.
Okay. We have all been to England, and I'm sure that you will all agree that I would rather drink jizz than drink anything coming out of the pipes in an old English manner. I can tell you that. You're safe for doing that. I think that was him hedging his bets. It's like drinking wine in the Middle Ages. You want that more than water.
I think regardless, you need a tetanus shot. Let's just be clear on that.
But you know, something that's interesting to me about this movie is right off the bat, we're already starting with the jizz drinking. That bathtub scene has captured the imagination of queer people and like meme generators everywhere, which is fascinating to me mm-hmm. because it's not even number 3 on the most shocking things that happen in the film. Like, haven't we all gone nuts in love for a person like that? Or is it just me? I don't know.
I've sniffed cologne on a jacket, Ryan. I don't know how often I have followed someone into the bathroom. Anyway, whatever.
Mortifying straight people. Like, I'm on TikTok and the straight people are fucking losing their minds. And I'm with you, Ryan. I'm just kind of like, okay, it's gross, but whatever.
If these straight people can't handle salt burn, I think they should stay away from my Twitter feed because it's going to be a rude awakening for them.
Well, I just think that if people find, and by the way, the movie we're doing today is Emerald Fennell's Saltburn. I didn't mention the title in case you haven't already guessed, in case you thought that Golda with Helen Mirren also had a jizz slurping bathtub scene. Which, you know, it could have used one. Let me just put that out there. I think that there's nothing shocking about this movie. And I think that it says a lot of things about mainstream audiences that people even find this movie shocking. Because the two things I heard about the most were the jizz slurping scene and his dick out dance at the end. Because Emerald Fennell, for some reason, thinks that Barry Keoghan is the body we want to drink in throughout this entire movie.
Is he not? I am going to sit here and I am going to stand for my fellow Irish person. Barry is a cutie. I look at him and I'm inflamed with lust. He activates all my, like, my toxic caretaking triggers. He's delicious. He's wonderful.
But Ryan, he also has many physical personas. At the very beginning, he looks like a very young Stephen Harper. Mm-hmm. And then he turns into the mad, cracked boy. Because he's got that cute little nose and everything. Yeah. But I agree with you. He's got a killer bod. He's super cute. And, you know, I'm not going to complain about the end by any means. But, yeah, but he's very much a chameleon.
I mean, why wouldn't God make it up to him by giving him that penis? You know?
Hey, like,
why not?
Hey, shout out to our short kings, man. Our short kings.
But I do have to note, I'm not saying it's not real, but there is a credited prosthetics designer in the end credits. So,
but he gave an interview and he said that that was really him.
Okay. I'm sure he would.
Usually, they don't flop properly. That's usually how you can tell, is the fake dicks don't usually flop properly.
So what's the prosthetic though? That's what I want to know.
The makeup on like the injuries, I guess.
I suspect the makeup department's doing the most heavy lifting on his face. Because while I was watching the movie, I was thinking, this guy has Irish skin like me. And they're making him look so even.
Yeah.
And even at times they make him look so opulent and sumptuous visually that, speaking of a movie we were just talking about before we press record, he kind of looked like Anshul in Yentl. Yeah. Like, you know how like Barbara thinks she's cross-dressing just by cutting her hair? That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, I don't know. And he also looks like Joe from Facts of Life. I mean, I don't know. Barry Keoghan is not really my thing, but Ryan is here to prove that there's a lid for every pot and, you know, no one goes unnoticed.
There's a shamrock for every leprechaun, you could say.
I thought this movie was total garbage. I am amazed that Emerald Fennell won an Oscar for writing a script, because at this point I wonder if she can even read a script. She's kind of like an Ari Aster or a Diablo Cody, where they write things in the spirit of seeming to think they're the first people to ever think of anything.
Yeah.
Michelle Collins calls this movie The Talented Mr. Gen Z, which I think is really funny. She sort of reconfigures The Talented Mr. Ripley and Brideshead Revisited and Teorema, thinking that she's the only person who's ever seen these movies. And it drove me crazy throughout this entire film. I was in a bad mood for the rest of the day. I went to bed angry. This 2-hour movie felt like it was 5 hours long. And honestly, I would rather watch Xanadu again than listen to Ryan talk about how much he loves this fucking movie.
Wow. I feel attacked in this moment. I'll say it. But you know,
it's a podcast.
A similarity between Xanadu and Saltburn is that they are not movies that I think were meant to be analyzed or critiqued or held up to what we want a good movie to be. They're just a simple good time. I definitely hear like the Brideshead and Mr. Ripley analogies, but to me, the big influence on the film is Dynasty, the TV show from the 80s. You watch it, and then you take a shower and you move on with the rest of your life. You got to watch some beautiful rich people being horrible. That's all I need.
First of all, thank you for letting us know what Dynasty is. I really appreciate you qualifying that as if I'm not on season 5 right now, first of all. But I completely disagree with you. I think that she does mean for this movie to be a critique of British class system. Again, thinking that she's the first person to think of this, even though it's been done a billion times, because British people are the only society in the world that are willing to even talk about class. And the fact that she even calls out Brideshead Revisited in the film, thinking she can get away with it by saying, oh, it's based on my house. I think that she totally means for this movie to be deconstructed as sociologically. I do not think that this movie is meant to be a good time.
She also makes a reference to Common People by Pulp, which is like one of the biggest class critique pop jams of the 90s.
Which is also a really funny scene. That's apparently Rosamund Pike made that up on the set as a joke, and Emerald Fennell decided to put it in the script because she's like, I think my character thinks Common People was written about her. Because Rosamund Pike is, you know, let's say quirky to be nice.
Something I think we should also talk about is not just the Pulp reference, but it was interesting to me watching the movie, what the movie got right with this references and what it got wrong with this references. Like the Livestrong bracelet on Elordi's wrist. Nice right. touch. Absolutely would have happened. But Low by Flo Rida hadn't come out yet. The candies that are in one scene later on the movie, they weren't out for another 3 years. So it's these little details where it's like, sometimes you got it, and sometimes it's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Why do you think she sets it in 2006? Do you think it's just because she doesn't feel like dealing with smartphones? Or is it because it's about her generation?
But wait, they deal with smartphones, though, because Farley had a smartphone. Well, like a flip phone or whatever.
He had a flip phone, yeah. We had flip phones in 2006. We didn't get iPhones until 2008.
There should have been BlackBerries. BlackBerries were the class status item at that time, and they don't feature at all.
Hmm. Well, here's the thing about this movie also, is that I don't think it even gets its examination of class status right. First of all, in my mind, old money British families don't live in castles anymore because they want to blend in better. If they still own that castle, they've turned 95% of it into a museum, and they might visit one room of it, and the rest of the time they keep a place in town. The people who own those castles and live in them are new money people, like rock stars who made it big and buy the country manor to live in and never quite blend in to the old money life that they want to, even though they have the money to spend on it. And I feel like this is something she gets very wrong, including in the casting of Jacob Elordi, who is, as we know, one of the most handsome people that God ever made. I mean, it's insane how good looking he is, but he doesn't look like old money to me. His father's like,
he's got tattoos and piercings and everything.
He's like Basque Spanish. Like
part of me was also thinking that I missed something. Am I missing something? Because like, even the furniture, it's like original furniture, practically, like original drapes. Everything's velvet. Everything's dark. Everything's wood, that kind of thing. And I was kind of like, because it also threw me off as well, because they're watching The Ring. They're, you know, they're very much a modern, stupid, you know, Cackley
family. Houses exist in England, but they usually have been turned into museums. But then you find out that every once in a while, the family comes and stays there and the museum is closed for that day. Ryan, you were going to say something. I'm so sorry.
I definitely was going to say, for me, this might be the first sizzling hot take of this episode. I think Jacob Elordi is, I would put him at the third or fourth most good-looking person of the cast. And I would put Barry, as much as I love him, at number two. The hot piece of the cast is the actor who plays Farley, Archie Madekwe. For me, that is the sexy villain. The second that he showed up with glitter on his cheeks, his hair puffed out, I was like, I'm looking in a mirror. I am seeing myself reflected in a film.
You like a man with scary spice hair, is what...
It's true. Always have, always will. I also think he had some really fun character moments, but we'll get to them later. I just wanted to say, off the top, he's on the screen, I was melting with desire.
That's interesting. He's a very attractive young man. I've seen him in two movies where he plays a whiny bitch both times, and so I have yet to find him attractive.
Thank you. That's what I thought. Whiny bitch the whole time. But his physicality and his presence on screen, you can't miss him. You love him. It's fantastic. Sure.
But Ryan, let me put you on the spot, because a friend of mine said that one of the things he hated about this movie is that the one character of Claire is also like the underhanded, shitty one. The one who's like coded as the most queer as well. So tell us, Ryan, give us the final word on that. No reason.
I'd like to take a moment and stand up and speak for Black people everywhere on behalf of my race. No. I'm somebody who thinks that when we get into situations where people of color are only portrayed as heroes, are only portrayed as sympathetic, we've lost the plot creatively. I am here for the villains. I grew up loving villains. I grew up admiring the dark machinations of somebody who's plotting to get something done. So for me, like, I've made a joke about how similar I find the character of Farley to myself, but I really, you know, like, people of color aren't perfect. Like, people of color are just as sneaky and gross and badly behaved as everybody else. So why can't we put that on screen?
Without a doubt. Yeah,
but also Farley had a really great moment when just about he was going to get that handy J from Ollie, and he's like, "Are you going to be a good boy?" And the first thing he says is no, and that really struck me as a really poignant moment, because typically when someone's being seduced, like the sister, she just submitted right away. He did not submit, and I, you know, to your point, it's good to see both sides of any sort of character, no matter what race, religion, you know, creed, all
for
that.
Sure. Thing. And like, and I also believe in, you know, letting everybody have a chance to be a villain. This is why I love Javier Bardem in Skyfall, which some people told me they found offensive because they were trying to be straight allies. And I told them to not work so hard. I only ask because a friend of mine brought it up. I thought there's other people who have questions about this, and I thought it was worth discussing. But it is also because she does present, she is talking about old money England, and that one of the ways that things are changing is that you have like a member of the family marrying outside of, you know, white people. And that's why you have the distant relative of a character like Farley. And is she trying to not make a commentary about that, but is there a reason why she's including that? But then the question is, what is she even doing with all of these characters? Because I find all of these characters incredibly inconsistent in the way that she writes them. We're supposed to figure out, and this is a spoiler-filled episode, by the way, so if anyone who's listening has never watched it, too bad.
We started off with that.
Did we? Okay. But Oliver Quick, which is also a name that makes me want to punch her in the face. But anyway, Oliver, we find out at the end, has been engineering this entire thing that he put the nail in the bicycle tire. Then, you know, make it clear to me, like, is it an act when he actually does want to be seen and appreciated by Felix? Or has it been an act the entire time? I feel like she changes her mind about who these people are and what they do the entire time. The fact that the mom, played by Rosamund Pike, is disingenuously generous to her best friend, played in only two scenes by Carey Mulligan, and then turns out to be glad to be rid of her and doesn't even care when she dies. But then at the end, even though Oliver has the same situation of being this like sort of interrupting upstart, she really wants him to stick around. There's a lot of things that felt very vague to me in terms of how often these characters change their minds about who they are.
Yeah. And I also, to that note, I also feel like in terms of any sort of backstory that we're not privy to, and we may be left to our own devices, and that's fine. I feel like that is inconsistent. That was not well thought out, because it really, there's really no through line from character development, from Ollie being, you know, naive and innocent and new and on a scholarship and, yeah, you know, down class, to him going to Saltburn, to him being completely manipulative, and us trying to kind of figure out, well, why are these people like that?
Well, we're supposed to assume that we know why he wants to get in with these people, but there isn't a scene where he's at school and all the other kids are like, look, that's Felix. Everyone thinks Felix is so cool. Like, it's never quite clear. And then once they get to Saltburn, we don't spend much time with him and Felix for a long time. We lose touch with that relationship for a very long time. So the fact that it's the central tension of the story doesn't make sense by the time we get back to them at the end. And then he murders him.
Yeah.
And this Bill, his name's Oliver Quick because her original name for him was already taken. It was Miss Havisham Fast.
I'm glad you're here, Greg. Does anyone hear the ocean? That's Ewan Mitchell, who's playing his abandoned friend at the end, who looks like when hot guys play nerds in gay porn. Cast an actual nerd and not what is clearly like a really buff. Yeah. Like, that guy was in Claire Denis' High Life. You see that he has a pretty killer rack. And also, it takes half an hour before we even get to Saltburn in this ridiculously long movie. That whole lead up to them visiting could have been done in a 5-minute montage of him just meeting the guy, being dazzled by him, working his way into his life, and then he's inviting him to a holiday. We did not need that much of this story, which is also an indication to me of how not intelligent this
is. You mean at Oxford?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I kind of feel a little bit of the opposite, where I kind of feel like it was too rushed, you know, because, you know, we get to meet these characters, we get the whole trope of, like, the cool kids versus the nerd, and, you know, how the nerd, like, gets in there, that kind of thing, and that's fine, it's all very Mean Girls, it's all good, but the thing is, what I, for the reward, and I say that very loosely, of Saltburn, I wanted to see a little bit more character development. I wanted to see Ollie a little bit more flourish from, you know, outsider to insider kind of thing. But of course, I don't want the movie to be 4 hours long because I would stab my eyes out.
I'm really surprised you found the movie to be really long, Bill, because for me, it was like a nice two-hour jaunt. It wasn't like a 3-hour epic, and it felt fairly clippy to me.
Ryan, have you really sat through this movie 6 times?
Yeah, have you?
I have. And I have a friend date to tomorrow night to make it 7.
I love it.
All right, we're going to
need to get you, Ryan, get you for me, a fella. I agree with you. It didn't feel like a really long movie because for me, visually, this movie was fantastic. Like the cinematography, the artistry was great.
Stylish, glamorous. Oh my God, the visuals of this movie. I was in heaven.
No, this movie had the same problem as Poor Things, which is the person making it clearly has a sense of style and has some what's the word I'm looking for? Like some aptitude as a metteur en scène. That's the best French you're going to get out of me.
I think it's metteuse in this case, but yes.
But it means nothing. It's to no end. This is a great font in these opening credits. Don't care. The cinematography, it's getting buzz actually for Academy Awards.
Yeah.
Why is it there?
Yeah.
Like this whole movie could actually be done like low budget with grainy 35mm and achieve more if it was written well.
Absolutely. And also let me point out that we are recording this before we record our BGM Oscar episode, but this episode will probably come out after we release that episode. So if we're talking about this movie anticipating Oscars, that is why. Don't write me an email about this, because the Oscar episode is when we get our rudest emails from our listeners, just so you know.
Jesus Christ.
Speaking of Oscars in this film, I would love to see a nomination for the soundtrack, because for me, as gorgeous as the visuals were, the beautiful music of this film really helped make it. And just so you know, I'm not just blowing smoke. It's on my phone. I've downloaded the soundtrack and I listen to the tracks from the movie on my phone.
Ryan.
But Ryan, does the soundtrack have the score and the songs, or is it just songs?
I'm talking about the original score. I'm not the additions of like Murder on the Dance Floor.
The score that you've got there, does that include the songs as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I know that one of the biggest pushes for awards for this movie is Rosamund getting a Best Supporting Actress nomination, which, I mean, I love Rosamund Pike. I think it's shocking that she's playing a mother at 44, a mother of grown people at 44, but fine. I do love her. I just find that this character is so badly written that everyone gives bad performances in this movie against their will, basically, because they're all talented people.
Yeah.
And that includes her. I didn't come out with a sense of who she was. And I know that Rosamund could give us this because this is also a kind of character that she can play in her sleep anyway, that kind of sort of frosty, soulless.
I enjoyed her.
I did too. This was the only like ray of sunshine in this movie for me. She's doing so much heavy lifting to fill this wooden dialogue with life and character. I thought she was fantastic. There's kind of echoes of her dippy character in An Education in this character as well.
Well, that's one of her finest performances. I love her in that movie so much.
And she's actually believable as a mother in this movie because she looks like the way rich older people stay young.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. She is technically a bit too young, but I don't know. Maybe she got married off at 18.
That's an important, actually, an important aspect of the film for me, because I feel like when I watch Rosamund Pike play that character, I know people like that. When I see Jacob Elordi play that character, I know people like that. And for me, one of the enjoyable parts of the movie was just how familiar all of those characters were.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was really kind of confused as to why are these characters such caricatures of rich people and so absurdist and so out of their element based on the backdrop of that giant fucking house. Like, for me, I almost felt like each character, if you put them on their own, they're exhilarating, they're exciting, you want to get to know them. But the minute they interact with another character that's also exhilarating, it implodes. It's almost like they're clashing for their sort of uniqueness and extrovertness.
Well, now you're just clearly stating what anybody who has ever hosted a party has discovered on their own. People individually don't always mix well.
But you have to know fabulous people. Sometimes you don't know them.
The answer, Mikey, is that the dialogue is extremely badly written. And it's in most cases, it's people saying what they mean instead of what they would actually say. There's a scene towards the beginning when Felix doesn't know that Oliver is behind him listening, and the girl says, no one wants to sit with Oliver. He's a scholarship kid. He dresses like shit, blah, blah, blah. No one actually says that, especially like snotty rich girls. They don't say that out loud because she wants Felix to like her. So what she would actually pretend is that she thinks Oliver's cool, even though she will also go out of her way to not never sit with him. That's how people actually behave. They don't actually say, I am evil.
And it was also written a la fucking Mean Girls spirit. You know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, and that's like, how everyone behaves at this film. Everyone's always saying what they mean instead of the way humans actually talk. And it's so clunky. Ryan, you're about to say something. I'm going to punch you in the face. What do you want?
I'm not about to say something. The reason that I'm smiling, the only reason that I'm smiling here is because we've just referenced Mean Girls a number of times. And God rest her soul, my mother is in Mean Girls. She was an extra in Mean Girls. She's in a bunch of scenes. And it was filmed at ECI, Etobicoke Collegiate Institute, which is the school that my grandfather was head of the math department at. So whenever I see or hear Mean Girls, it's always just a nice, like, oh, reminder of my family that's not here anymore. So it just makes me smile because it's nice to hear the record.
Say again, based on the writing, how it's not intelligent is that what I also found is all of Ollie's scheming, his planning, his calculations were not intelligent. They were risky, but they were not intelligent. And it shows in the writing because he's just all about words. And the one scene I can bring up is when he's with Rosamond. She's having her martini, she's looking beautiful. He talks about poor little Pauline. Is it Pauline? I'm not sure. I can't remember. And he says something really basic and simple, like, oh, well, if she's even telling the truth, you know, and then kind of like, is that your ploy? Is that how you manipulate people? Because it's really not smart. And that's the writing, in my opinion.
Well, and also, you put a nail in someone's bicycle, you could actually have him break his neck. So that's poor planning. And also, did he just leave the razors next to the sister in the bathroom?
Apparently.
Hope she take the hint, or did he actually kill her? Like that, it's all very vague in terms of his master plan. And then also, all of a sudden, Rosamund Pike is dying of something at the end. Like, that just comes out of nowhere. And then she put him in the will? Is that why he's naked in what is a very cold house?
That's what we're supposed to think, I think. Like, that's what I got. And I was like, that makes no sense.
Something else that's vague that I'd really like to get to the bottom of is, did Ollie and Farley stop at hand jobs, or did they fuck? We just don't know because it happens out of screen. And then later on, we just see them in bed together. I need to know. I need a director's cut.
Why?
I need the deleted blooper scenes. I need a deep dive into this important factual moment.
Why do you need to know, though?
But also, what did Farley supposedly steal that got him thrown out? Like, what did he plant on him? Bulls. Is that clear? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's threatening to sell the bowls to, I guess, some other dealer or buyer or something.
Well, yeah, because he was also doing research on Saltburn ahead of time and learning about these, like the antiques that they have in the house. But if he's doing that, then how come he doesn't also know that breakfast is self-serve, which, by the way, is stolen from Gosford Park because that's already happened in a movie. But why doesn't he already know that stuff? Like, if he's been, planning this in advance, why doesn't he know how to behave? Or if it's just that he's pretending, then why isn't it clearer to me that he's pretending?
It's like the movie wants to do this and that and ends up doing like a quarter of each. At times, it seems like he's so studied in the manners of the upper crust. And then at other times, it seems like he's too naive. And which is it? And then at the end of the movie, when it pulls that lazy usual suspects rug pull, listen to me, it makes it seem like he was plotting all of this so cleverly all along.
And carefully, even though it's all based on chance.
As well.
Yeah. And carefully, and the only part of it that rings true or resonates is that Barry Keoghan's is actually given it in this performance. Like, he really does feel malevolence. But
well, that's just his face. I mean, he always looks like he's up to no good. It works very well for him in a lot of the roles he's played.
The Caleb Landry Jones syndrome.
Yeah, not gross. Yeah.
But he is coming off as being really mischievous and wily, but yeah. none of the plot points are there. There's nothing to connect.
Well, he's not doing much. Like so the Richard E. Grant character, who by the way is one of the worst performances in this film, and I love that actor so much.
Yeah.
His performance is outrageously miscalculated, but he eventually kills himself because he's so distraught over the deaths of his children. But it's like, were you just going to wait years for that to happen? Why, if he's so smart, why didn't he like arrange some kind of financial scandal that would get him thrown in jail or make him want to kill himself? Like, why isn't he, if he's arranging things, why isn't he actually arranging things more?
Okay, so sorry, I missed that. So he actually killed himself? Why are there balloons everywhere?
That I don't know.
Wow.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Sorry, Mike just had graphics show up out of nowhere on his screen. Happy birthday, Mike.
Anyway, thank you.
It actually was his birthday.
Did Richard E. Grant kill himself in the movie? Like, is that how he died?
Well, the way she says, well, it was bound to happen, when he says, I'm really sorry to hear that he died, the way she reacted, it looked to me like he had committed suicide.
Oh.
That's how it seemed.
Okay, see, I missed that. And what I found really interesting is because this is in 2006, and I didn't really clue in on the time gap until they were in the cafe and I saw masks. And I was like, wait a minute. And then they cut to the newspaper article and says 2022. I was like, that's a really long time.
That's a really long, that's a really long plan. And also, if you're going to have her be sick out of nowhere, why not have scenes ahead of time in the movie where she reaches for an oxygen mask or something? Like, she has some kind of...
Or she gets sick or something, yeah.
Well, she already has some kind of syndrome or whatever. Or she's chain-smoking and people keep telling her, stop smoking, it's bad for you. And then in the end, it catches up. Why, again, poor writing. Poor first draft writing. Ryan, I swear to God. I swear to God.
So, I just want to point out, I just want to make the observation that the boy is dead, the sister is dead, the father is dead, the mother is dead. Do you know who isn't dead? Farley. Farley lived. We are setting up a sequel. We are setting up Saltburn 2, Farley's Revenge, where he comes back and comes after Ollie, and they have another romp in the sack and another whole long...
Ryan, it's not a shark movie.
Something I need, I think we need a scientist in this call right now, because I do need something explained for me. What are the possible infections or maladies that can be contracted by fucking soil of a fresh grave? Mm. With what I'm guessing is an uncut gem.
Yeah. I don't know. Or maybe it enriches his skin. Who knows? Maybe it's like the best facial ever.
Because if I'm Farley, I don't know if I want to go down on that right away.
Yeah, it's true. It might taste a bit loamy for a while.
Yeah.
Well, here's the other thing is that Farley isn't dead at the end of the movie, as you point out. He is disgraced, but then he bounces back because when he comes back for the party, he's like, just so you know, like when you're in with these people, you're in. There's nothing that can really get you out. So then why does Oliver inherit everything so easily? Why wouldn't Farley in the sequel come back and say he used undue influence to get her to put his name in all the papers? And this is actually my house.
And two things. Number one, the way Rosemond died when he pulls out the ventilator and whatever, she dies. Yeah. You have a house full of servants. There would be a CSI episode based on that scene alone. And secondly, you're right. Why would Farley not come back and fucking expose this guy? But instead, he's like dancing around, Wang out, being like, I own Saltburn, and the end.
I wondered that too, because I'm like, isn't there physical evidence if you yank someone's feeding tube out and make them die? Like, are there no forensics experts in England? Or are they all on Antiques Roadshow? Like, what is going on? But also, did he inherit the house or did he inherit their fortune/estate? Because those are two different things. Most old money families in England are no money families, which is why they've turned their castles into museums, is because they can't afford to keep them up.
I would probably say in the spirit of the movie, maybe the estate, which is, I guess, maybe worth money, but...
So he, is he paying the salaries for the servants? Like, does he have access to the bank account? And why do
and
they
why does he want it so badly? Who cares? Like, what are you going to do with that giant...
But also, a lot of those old, again, old money families, they usually, the money ran dry in, like, World War II, and if they still have money, there's usually a reason for it. Like, they got into some other kind of business. They don't really explain that, so then it's just like, what has he inherited?
But they had money because he, Richard E. Grant, the dad, was willing to pay him off. Like, right. How much do you want? Like, here's, yeah. You know, there's money that exists.
Where does it come from? I mean, the queen owns a McDonald's. Well, the late queen owned a McDonald's. Like, the royal family is involved in businesses like that to keep money coming in. That's why Prince Charles sells those biscuits.
Wait, is this real?
This is real. The queen owns a McDonald's.
What?
Owned.
Which one?
Specifically? I'm rubbing my wounds.
It's on like a highway. It's like a highway exit McDonald's. I can't remember which one. You can look.
It's
this
like
up.
An en route in the
yes.
UK McDonald's.
Yeah, yeah.
God. We need a movie about that.
Yeah, we need to go to that McDonald's and see if it's any different.
Yeah, like yeah. That.
But first, I want to go to the Arby's that Jack Donaghy co-owns in 30 Rock with Isabella Rossellini.
Yes.
The other ridiculous characterization in this film. By the way, the reason why Ryan's actually smiling is because he's never seen me this upset, and he is thrilled beyond belief. Anyway, hasn't been.
This might just be the episode that splits us up. Truly, like this might be the end of the road for us, Bill. Don't make a
no.
Markle me. Don't cut me off and send me out into the world alone.
Although we've gone to the end of the road.
I can't wait till the next time we see each other at a show and we just death glare at each other. And then fight over who gets to be Joan Collins and who gets to be Diane Carroll. Anyway, so the other ridiculous characterization for me is Paul Rees as the butler. Who has nothing better to do in this giant house, running a whole thing of servants, and he has nothing better to do than judge everybody who comes across his path. As if the kids in that house don't bring young, poor people over all the time that he has to deal with.
Listen, I loved him. I loved him. He was refreshing.
He has been acting for a long time. He was in a great Robert Altman movie called Vincent and Theo about 30 years ago. That's a really wonderful film. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it.
He was giving Doc the Mad Doctor from Human Centipede.
No, you're right. You're right.
Like something, he's definitely out of a genre movie. He's not like a real person.
So, listen, for this movie, I feel like they tried to put like little Easter eggs or nuggets or something, and it just got all missed. But I feel like his character, he knows shit. That girl has seen some shit at Saltburn. And you can tell by his mannerisms, you can tell by the limited lines he has, like, eventually everyone gets lost at Saltburn, and then the end. You know, I'm just kind of like, okay, maybe he was the most well-thought-out character. I don't know.
Why is he resisting Oliver so much? Like, why isn't he just taking his bag up to his room? Do you know what I mean?
Because he's seen all the characters. Like, I feel like he's very much, you know, that butler that's been there for generations until he dies, and he's seen some shit. He saw the shady characters. And there's also the alluding of like Felix's boy toys, even though I don't believe that in the script, because I actually do believe that Felix is just a genuine, straight, cis character who just experiences things because he's rich and that's fine. The end. But they really allude to like, summers of other characters coming in, boys, obviously, and it really doesn't go anywhere. So maybe the butler, like, really.
Well, because he's supposed to be the personification of privilege, right? Which is that everything comes so easily to him that he doesn't lift a finger, including the fact that he doesn't have to maintain his friendships because there's always people wanting to be his friend. And that people, he has his friends come for the summer and they think that they're in and they're only there for as long as he's amused by them. And then when he's bored of them, he just drops them.
Well, what I find really interesting about the movie is that every single character around Felix really characterizes Felix as somebody who uses people, somebody who is, you know, gay baiting people or whatever. And he's really not that throughout the whole movie.
Although that's usually how that kind of person is, and it's because people want them so badly. Like, they want something from them. Either they want to have sex with him, or they want to be him, or they want to be friends with him. And so they end up projecting a personality onto somebody who has zero personality, because they've never, ever needed one. You look at him, and you already get everything you need. And so why would he even lift a finger to even try to be someone? The thing that they kind of get wrong, though, is that usually we're supposed to... It's supposed to be the Dickie Greenleaf character, basically, which is that... somebody who comes off as being very effortless and charismatic turns out to actually be quite petty and selfish. While as in the case of Felix and Dickie Greenleaf, meaning Jude Law in The Talented Mr. Ripley, for those of you who have never read a book, like people who like this movie anyway. So
excuse me. If I am going to be called out for insinuating, listeners of this podcast do not listen, do not know what Dynasty is, I must take this moment to return the favor and say everybody watching this podcast not only knows who Dickie Greenleaf is, can do a Dickie Greenleaf impersonation. Thank you for your time.
Which is what? Knocking people over the head with a boat oar?
Thank you for your TED Talk, Ryan.
Ryan, there's really no one I love more than you, just so you know. So what they kind of get wrong is that Felix turns out to actually be quite reasonable. Like, I get why he doesn't want Oliver around at the end, which is not really what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to find out that he's actually kind of a dick, even though we've been in love with him this entire time. So that's, again, something that's rather miscalculated. And then Venetia is the sister who, again, miscasting. That girl does not come off as being...
Correct. Like,
that's the girl that Jude Law leaves behind in the council flat in order to pursue, you know, the girl with actually good hair. Is she supposed to be sleepwalking in that scene where he rubs her period blood in her mouth? Is that the idea? Or is she drunk?
I don't think so. I actually take Rosamund Pike's explanation of her daughter being like, she's basically like a sexual... There's the balloons again. Why?
The listener, I'm so sorry you're missing out on this visual, but for some reason, Mike has party balloons, animated party balloons flying up through his video feed anyway. Her explanation.
I believe that she's a sexual deviant. I believe that she's, you know, she's just fucking horny all the time and apparently bulimic. And I think he preyed on that, obviously.
That for sure. I just couldn't tell if they were implying that she was in some kind of altered state in that scene, or is she awake?
Is she pretending not to remember it the next day,
or she doesn't remember it?
When he ate her out the next day, remember, he was kind of like, you're going to eat and you're going to stay at the table. And she remembered everything, and she did. Okay. Eventually, she did not. Okay. But,
I love Rosamund.
Which also, can we just say, did you guys find that scene more shocking, with air quotes, than the bathtub scene?
I'm the wrong person to ask. I've had this blue bear slice her vagina like a million times by now. I have I'm unflappable.
We're all desensitized.
Honestly, I'll see you later tonight at Woody's when I'm doing Diva Cup drop shots.
Perfect. And we've just lost 800 subscribers. One review that I agreed with that did not like this movie talked about how, like, the most that this film could think of to do in terms of conflict is a passive-aggressive karaoke selection. This is the worst Farley can do, is make him say embarrassing lyrics, as if anyone ever pays attention to what anyone is singing in a karaoke situation.
That's the mark of a villain, of a great villain character. Their evil trick is never as effective as they want it to be. And then we watch them deal with the fallout of it, and it's entertaining. And I think that applies to that whole that whole karaoke scene.
But he also, like, he took charge of it, right? Because he totally set up Ollie for that song, and then Ollie realized that, and then he's like, oh, hey, Farley, get in here, because obviously you're also that, you know, pay my rent. And he just took charge and, like, sung it, and, you know.
Why is that the worst he can do? Like, if he's going to get Farley by framing him for stealing, why isn't Farley, like, nearly as bad? I mean, this isn't even as bad as Legally Blonde, like making her come to a party in her Playboy bunny outfit.
Because I don't think Farley's bad really in nature. I think he's just fucking whiny and bitchy in nature, and that's fine, whatever. I think it's unfortunate for the character though, because that, again, that's in the writing. You know, there's no real, well, and I don't know where I'm like, he needs more motivation. There any conversation that Farley can have without being one-liners or being really bitchy?
Yeah,
you know,
he needs more motivation that's clear to us in the fact that he is, like, he's cousins with this guy. He might be a little bit into him. His cousin is, you know, presents more as old money, given that he's, like, a cute white guy, and that he never gets to feel his privilege of his background because people don't see it when they look at him. On top of which, he's actually from, like, the poor relatives of this old money family. So, like, there's all these motivations there that I don't really feel are... the actor is giving me.
But I think in terms of character development and writing, they could have given Farley a couple moments for him to humanize him a little bit, right?
He turns out to be a bit passive, especially when he, like, it turns out, like, he does desire sex with Ollie when he, you know, sneaks into his room or whatever. But
Yeah, like, that's actually believable because, like, I fucked someone who was, like, the head of, like, conservatives at Western University. Like, you know, if they look good, you'll go home.
Well, that's, but those are the, like, conservatives are the best in bed. We all know this. We're not supposed to say it, but, like,
closet. How was Pierre Poilievre?
Yeah.
Catholics are the best in bed.
Anyone who hates themselves and sex is the best in bed, because that's when they really shine, you know?
I'm shuddering at the thought of Sam Oosterhoff being good in bed. I can't reconcile that.
Well, you know who I did go to Western with? You know who was the head of my student council? Stephen Lecce.
Oh.
Wow.
But what I was going to say about that scene where he's performing Rent, back to your point, Mike, about bad writing. It's like he realizes he's singing Rent halfway through singing it. Like, that song is popular over here. I imagine it must be 20 times more famous in the UK.
Totally.
And as soon as you start it, you're like, oh, it's that song about being in love, like having a relationship with somebody who you live off of, riding their coattails.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as the beat starts and Farley calls him over, he should be like, I see what you're trying to do. Don't fucking try it. But then he's like, I love you. You pay my rent.
It's so painful. Painful.
I get the impression that Emerald Fennell is creating a movie about this world based on only knowing it from the movies. For me, what feels like the inconsistencies, even though I get the impression she's like, I don't know, she comes from a family of well-to-do artists. Her father went to Eton. So I don't know if she's like really Tony or just like, you know, cushy middle class. I don't know. And I don't really care. In my imagination or in my experience, and then certainly in the terms of the way they're presented in movies, rich people don't sit around telling everybody, oh my God, we're so rich, you're not good enough for us. Rich people want everyone to think that they're good so that everyone will agree that they deserve to be where they deserve to be. So they don't venomously treat strangers in their midst. They actually convince themselves that they're being normal and cool and kind to everybody, even though they're being condescending against their better judgment. And that's something that this movie miscalculates very badly all the time.
But I'm okay with being given the ride of caricature and farce and colorful characters.
Yeah.
That's okay. You know, because none of this really sort of gels together. You know, it's like a puzzle with like five missing pieces.
Yeah.
But you know what it is. You've seen it before, but you can't really put it all together because there are pieces that are missing. But do it well. And I find that, to your point, Bill, she, in her research, in her writing, in her artistic choices for plot outline, it's missing.
It's because she doesn't have a sense of humor. She doesn't have humor, and that was missing from Promising Young Woman, too.
Yes, and I almost feel like they rushed, and I say they in terms of like writing staff and whatever, you know, designers, but they rushed everything just to get to the visuals. because I will stand by the fact that I do think that this movie is visually appealing. Sure. Does it make sense? No, it's eye candy. I get it. That's fine. But for me, that was the big standout moment of the movie. There was a lot of thought being considered in the artistry of this, and it seems like everything else was second nature. And
well, yeah, because me, if it was funny, it could get away with the outrageous characterizations of these.
Rosamund was funny. I found her funny. And I also found Carrie Mulligan really funny, even though I'm very quirky. She was good.
Yeah, she is. It's just, it's supposed to be funny that the morning after her son ODs and dies, she's like, did you enjoy your party? Like, that's not a logical way for people to behave. So if they're going to do that,
correct,
it has to be hilarious, not, oh, look how ridiculous rich people are, that she's asking how the party was. No one would do that.
And that's exactly what I mean, because that was the one point where I was like, I'm out, because you can be really, like, farcical and crazy and be like, oh, we're going to have lunch after, like, practically on the day I discovered my son being dead. Yeah. But again, it made no sense. There was no artistic choice that made sense there.
As a Black person and also as a WASP, though, I will say I recognize that WASP behavior a mile away. And, like, weirdly, that was another moment of the movie that I was like, yeah, I've been in those conversations 100%. So, I don't know. I think it's, like, not necessarily a class thing so much as maybe, like, a British thing. Maybe a Protestant thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But she seems like she genuinely wants to know how he enjoyed his party. She doesn't seem like she's making conversation because she doesn't know how to deal with what's really happened. And so that leads me to believe that the movie is lampooning her ridiculous craziness. Even though at least one person in this family should be practical and smart, because even if they are still rich after many generations, you have to run that house and you have to keep an eye on how that house is run. And someone has to be able to do that in terms of salaries, in terms of upkeep, in terms of do we spend the money on a new roof this year because it's going to cost £80,000, or do we do that next year? Like, there has to be one person in the family who can do that. Yeah, just be like, leave the servants to do it.
No, but also, and yet, the dad in that scene, let's dissect that scene if we can, the scene where the coroner is going to walk by and the drapes and everything's red and Venetia, whatever her name is, like, pours the wine and, like, it's all over the place. And, like, that whole scene for me was just an artistic choice. And the dad all of a sudden became very human, right? He wasn't a sort of caricature of himself. You know, he was dealing with the servants and, like, shut the blinds and blah, blah, blah. But again, with the writing and again, with the lack of thought on this, what I found really disturbing or upsetting or irritating, I should say, is the fact of how Farley got called out for the final time on that. And that's only because Ollie was like, oh, you did lines and how convenient when your son dies. I was like, to me, that's like, that's not well thought out dialogue or writing. Yeah. That's it. And then all of a sudden Farley's out.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually less of a concern than actually trying to allegedly auction off bowls to another art dealer. Do you know what I mean? Like,
since when is cocaine a deal breaker in that world?
And also, if you're that kind of family that's so quirky and crazy and throwing parties the way that you do, as if you don't hear about drugs or do them yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
they're kind of family that have IV drips in everybody's chambers the morning after the party.
Yeah, and force vitamin B shots on their guests, even though they're like, please stop putting needles in me. Yeah.
They're the type of family that in their basement are the video games that I play, the horror video games. Like, let's just make that
Castlevania.
Clear.
Their basement is Castlevania.
They have the blood bag people from Mad Max Fury Road.
Totally. And Greg's got Universal Receiver tattooed on his back. Anyway. So we can wrap up. We're going to get a flurry of emails from angry people defending this movie, and I appreciate and love you all. Before we go, let's each say one thing we love about this movie that we haven't already. Ryan, you go first.
Farley makes the movie, in my opinion. I think he's beautiful. I think he's deliciously villainous. I think he's very funny. I think he's very, very human. But aside from the character Farley, the actor, Archie Madekwe, I'm really quite taken with as an actor. After this movie, I went into his filmography a bit and watched some of his other work, and he's really, really excellent. I watched some of his interviews, and he speaks about the craft very, very intelligently. Very, very smart guy. So for me, as much as it's the Jacob and Barry show, I really, really love this movie in large part because of the character of Farley.
Yeah, it's the movie feels like a first draft. It's basically written around needle drops, especially and not even well-placed needle drops because it takes place in 2006, but that MGMT song is from 2007. The takeaway for me is Rosamund Pike. If she gets nominated, I'll giggle because that means we get to see one of her funny scenes at the Oscars and her little clip moment. Even though she's probably kicking out a better performance like Julianne Moore with a lisp.
I'm going to say, I already said it, but I'm going to say the artistry, the art direction, the cinematography, those little like comic book moments where I'll call one scene out when he was like fucking the grave. If you really look at the clouds in the background, I'm really curious as to whether that's like green screen or an actual like a flat or if it's actually just filters because I was really looking at the clouds and they really looked like they were moving but they really weren't, and I was like, I feel like there's a painting there that they kind of put as a backdrop, right? So who knows, again, a missed artistry moment, if you know, you know, that kind of thing. But I would say, yeah.
It tells you how hot we are for Barry Keoghan that you were looking at the clouds while he was naked fucking the ground. Like, is that real?
True.
Fun fact, 98% of the skies you see in movies are computer generated. Most of the time they are fake because no one needs to wait for a good day to shoot anymore. For me, also Rosamund Pike, that wonderful line that she has when she says, oh, I was a lesbian for a minute, but I got tired of how wet it was. Men are so deliciously dry. Men are so lovely and dry. That's so great. And she, you know, she's the perfect actress to nail that. I think she's an incredibly talented actor and a Bond girl. I also loved seeing Dorothy Atkinson as Oliver's mom, although that scene is also sort of a missed opportunity in terms of just what kind of plain downtroddenness we could have found his real family to be in. But I do like that actress. She's in Topsy Turvy, which is one of my favorite movies. She plays the actress who has the abscess on her leg. I can't remember her name. I really loved talking about this movie with you boys. Thank you all for joining today. Ryan, thank you for suggesting this film. Thank you, as always, for every time you come on the show and allow yourself to be thoroughly insulted by me and then still act like you know me when you see me in public. I appreciate it. You are for sure one of my favorite people on the planet.
I adore you, Bill, forever and ever and ever. Amen. Even though you don't love Xanadu as much as I do, even though you don't love this film as much as I do, there's frankly no one else I'd rather discuss the films with. And Mike and Greg, lovely to see you as always.
I would watch Xanadu 10 more times before I would sit through this movie again.
Me too.
And Greg and I are outliers this season for being the only two people, it turns out, who really did not like Poor Things. And I would watch Poor Things again before I would watch this.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you like it, don't tell me. I don't want to know. Ryan, tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you, all that stuff.
I'm on all of the social media platforms at Ryan G. Hines, RyanGHinds. Just my name. I'm easily findable on the internet. And I like interacting with people, so tweet me and I will definitely tweet you back.
Greggy, as always, thank you for joining us today. It's so weird to have so many guests to thank one after the other. Of course, we will have you on again soon. I think there's no social medias to promote for you, correct?
No, though you can just find me fucking soil in the construction, in the construction site of the Portlands and chugging period blood and bath jizz, just like any other person.
Yeah.
In the Portlands as well?
Yeah. Bring it on.
Okay. Bring Why not?
Mike.
No, but can I since I don't have social media, I want people to go and find this small movie that went on, like, without Oscar buzz that Rosamund Pike is in that was great, called A Private War.
Mm.
She's fantastic in that movie.
Which we saw together, which stars Super Snack and a Half Jamie Dornan.
Oh.
Yeah. That is actually a really good movie. She's very good in that. I think about that character a lot, actually. But she's great. She's so razor sharp and she's so fearless. I mean, the fact that when she gives interviews and turns out to be a little bit crazy is sort of appropriate because it makes sense why her performances are so grounded and uncompromising. You know, I like it when she plays soulless women. In An Education, I think she's brilliant for the fact that you cannot see any intelligence behind those eyes. It's incredible how well she plays that part.
Have I seen that?
I love that movie.
I have to double check.
Mikey, wonderful to see you as always. And we have your episode to do soon as well. But in the meantime, yeah. Tell our listeners where they can find you.
You can also find me at the Portlands. No, I'm joking. You can find me on Instagram. Just call it Instagram. Michael C. Sue Large. That's right. S-O-U Large. And yeah, that's it.
All right.
That's where you can find me.
All right, boys. Thank you very much. And we'll see you all soon.
Bye, guys. Bye.